You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's take a trip back in time to some hard times, not unlike the ones we're experiencing right now.
Dead enders, kicking up cinders. I've been having some hard traveling alone.
That's singer Cameron Dye covering Woody Guthrie's Hard Travelin' at the onset of a new play called We Live On. The play is based on Studs Terkel's Hard Times, which details experiences during the Great Depression. Really hard times, right? It explores 30 different accounts, a mix of those documented by Terkel himself, and original stories from cast members, too. Here's one from part two of the play.
Sally Rand describes the onset of the Great Depression suspiciously. Suddenly, all the copybook maxims were turned backwards, she said. How could it be that a man who had been at his job 30 years couldn't have a job? How could it be that a business that had been in business a lifetime suddenly isn't anymore? Friends of hers who had been to Harvard, Yale, Princeton jumped out of windows. With accuracy, she said.
That was actress Patty Tippo. Tim Robbins directs the play. You may know him from his many roles on the big screen, including Andy Dufresne in The Shawshank Redemption, but he's also the co-founder and artistic director of the Actors Gang Theater Company in Culver City and has been for the past 4 decades. And he's here right now to talk about his new play in the great world of theater. Tim, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve.
Now, I've been down there, and I know you've got a nice little elaborate setup there. Right near downtown Culver City. What inspired this play? Why'd you want to do this one?
Well, when the lockdown hit last year, we, as a theater company, couldn't obviously assemble together, and we usually do a weekly workshop. So we continued to do our workshops virtually, finding out quickly that Zoom is not very friendly for theater. It's very difficult to do scenes with each other. The timing alone is a nightmare just because there's a delay. But also, you know, the glitches, and you're asking an audience to believe that these two people that are in separate rooms are in the same room. A whole bunch of factors, a lot of obstacles. So what we started to do was we started to work individually. One person talking, one person speaking to the camera in the computer. A very intimate, personal relationship with the audience. At the Actors Gang, we don't use a fourth wall when we're live on stage. We acknowledge that the audience is there. It's part of our whole aesthetic. And so adapting to this new medium was difficult at first, but we already were completely behind the concept of direct address. It's just that we had to figure out ways to do it in a much more intimate and personal way.
It's like a monologue, right? I mean, you're looking at the...
Yes.
Yeah, you're looking out at the people watching.
Right. And so we figured that this would be very rich material to work on. And I had known Studs when he was alive. I had actually interviewed him for LACMA in the early 90s. And I had always been a fan of his. He's the great chronicler of the anonymous in America. Hmm. And so what you hear is the experience of the common man and woman that were going through very, very difficult struggles in the early 1930s. And the more we read through these pieces, the more we realized how these could have been written yesterday. The same things were happening. This repetition of history that is too often prevalent because we don't learn enough from our own mistakes in the past. And so the evictions and the homelessness and the and the kind of gig economy was huge back then. There were over 2 million people riding the rails looking for work when the jobs in their hometowns had dried up. And so we just immediately knew that this was going to be relevant. We had no idea whether the audience was going to respond to it, though. And when we started to do it in workshop in June, we quickly understood that not only were people coming to it, but they were also coming to the talkbacks afterwards and hanging in with us. Hmm. For an hour and 20 for the show and another hour and 20 for the talk back. So we understood that there was something necessary in this material.
What similarities do you, I mean, we talk about, you know, obviously the way that the Depression happened, it was pretty fast. There was a crash of the stock market, and then things just got worse. And I wonder, you know, with COVID, it was also pretty fast. Many jobs were lost very quickly. And people became very, you know, feeling paranoid about the future. Not, I mean, feeling really pessimistic about the future. And I wonder, I mean, because this is highlighting the 30s, you got to be really careful in trying to make it parallel to what we're dealing with today.
Yes. Well, the reason why we wanted to do it was because we understood that in the midst of the recovery from this, we're going to need stories that remind us of the strength, resilience, and the community, I think, that was so important to people that were going through those struggles back then. The way through this is by finding common bond with other people. Our job is to be in the business of telling stories that reflect all of our experience, but also finding the humanity and the resilience and amplifying that.
Yeah. The Actors Gang, I mean, you're a theater troupe. Small theaters have had a terrible time. We're not gathering anymore. And I know, I mean, like I said, I've been to one of your shows, and it's a pretty tight-knit kind of stadium seating looking at the stage, and you can't do that in the middle of a pandemic. How'd you manage?
Well, we as an organization, committed early on to not furlough anybody, to keep everyone on health insurance, and to figure out how to survive that way. We didn't lay off anybody. So we have other programs, education programs, prison work that we do. And we adapted immediately those programs to other mediums. But also, as a presenting organization, it was incumbent upon us to figure out how to get back into that theater. We did the other day. We went in and did a rehearsal in person of We Live On. We were figuring out a way we can open up the theater. It's, you know, it's going to be difficult. We're going to survive it. Unfortunately, a lot of small theaters have not survived, and it hasn't been helpful that there have been other pressures being put on the LA theater community from not only Actors Equity, but AB5. So it's going to be an interesting couple years.
Well, I want to talk to you about that, actually.
Okay.
Talk to me about AB5. This is the gig worker law that was passed in 2020. In Sacramento, that required companies hire independent contractors to reclassify them as employees. Has your organization been affected by it?
So what started as a what I think a legitimate desire to figure out a way for Uber and Lyft and gig workers to get representation. Now it's become about nonprofit theater companies. Uber and Lyft kind of lobbied their way out of being regulated by that bill. And we're unfortunately part of a group of people that are freelance workers that want to be able to work. Now, the Musicians Union was very strong, and they carved out an exception in AB5 for bands, for example, that want to get together and rehearse. They're not going to have to comply. Actors Equity was not there for the LA actors and haven't been for quite a few years.
You mentioned that Uber and Lyft did seek out exemptions from AB5 successfully. Are you guys collectively as theater owners and groups going to try to find an exemption in the theater realm?
We have been trying. There have been people from theaters all over Los Angeles lobbying legislatures. Apparently, they don't have as much sway as the billionaires that are running Uber and Lyft. So the labor law is now about us. It's not about gig workers anymore.
Actor and director Tim Robbins from the Actors Gang. Tim, thanks.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
By the way, the virtual three-part production, We Live On, runs through September 4th via Zoom.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
As L.A. slowly emerges from months of isolation, seeking out culture, L.A. theaters continue to face big challenges as they try to keep the lights on. Challenges such as whether folks are actually ready to sit inside a theater without a mask on, or maybe with masks, or the gig worker bill, AB5, which some folks fear will drive up labor costs. Well, here to talk about it and to tell us how the community is confronting those challenges is Tiffany Moon, producing director of one of those small theaters, Greenway Court Theater in Fairfax. Tiffany, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And our friend, of course, longtime theater critic Anthony Burns is also with us as well. He usually hosts Opening the Curtain right here on KCRW. Anthony, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
Nice to have you on. Tiffany, I'm going to start with you. How has Greenway been doing during the pandemic? How are y'all doing?
Well, we're definitely hanging in there. Greenway is a little bit unique in compared to the other 99-seat theaters in Los Angeles in that our organization is a bit larger. We also run the Melrose Trading Post and have the Greenway Institute of the Arts that does arts education, primarily with Fairfax High School, which is where we are located on the campus. We were able to reopen the Melrose Trading Post at reduced capacity in August 2020. So we've definitely, that's been very helpful in keeping our full-time staff employed and keeping our lights on for now. Of course, the theater's been closed due to regulations, and right now we are a bit uncertain about what the future holds for reopening.
Are you guys nonprofit? I mean, most theaters are nonprofit organizations relying on, you know, the ticket sales and fundraising, stuff like that. Is that true for Greenway?
Oh, yes, 100% nonprofit. We do, the Melrose Trading Post does a lot of fundraising for Fairfax High School, as well as supporting our nonprofit theater and arts education programs. And we do keep our ticket sales low, as many of the 99-seat theaters do. Most of us have a great commitment to community engagement and making it as accessible as possible.
Anthony, you know, COVID restrictions are slowly, I mean, they've been lifted, obviously, but then we're seeing the Delta variant and things starting to get a little janky lately. How have small theaters been managing to stay afloat through all of this? My gosh.
Well, you know, it's a really, really challenging time and absolutely unprecedented, right?
Yeah.
So the biggest piece is, you know, what is this doing to audience patterns, and are people changing what they want to come back to? And a lot of those patterns have been broken. Now, small theaters in some ways might be slightly better positioned than the larger theaters, right? Because if you've got a small theater and you haven't had to pay rent and you could have essentially sort of hibernate during this time, maybe the pandemic is an amazing moment to recharge, to, you know, reinvest in all of your kind of artistic goals, to figure out what you're really doing, to, you know, clean up the office, do all that kind of stuff. So if you've been able to make it through that, then maybe you've got a really good chance of coming out. Unfortunately, the folks it's probably hurting the most, or certainly is hurting the most, are the quote unquote more professional of the smaller theaters, the folks who both have a physical space and have a staff that they've had to, you know, cover their costs of those folks, or even worse, maybe had to lay those folks off. And are those people with all that institutional knowledge who were so critical to making the organization run going to come back after this? So there are a lot of open questions.
You mentioned smaller theaters being able to handle this. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about Equity's decision, right, to force theaters to pay minimum wage. These, even the fewer than 99-seat theaters, right, which has really hammered them as well. You heard Tim Robbins talking about AB5, and you know, that it was the big tech companies that found a way to sort of, you know, to get out of AB5, but then everybody else was sort of stuck with the bill. I mean, if a small theater needs to increase wages of their staff because of that new law, where does the money come from? I mean, how do they deal with that?
So we have on one side the kind of 99-seat exemption historically, which, you know, we need to remember was a group of actors saying, let us do this for free so we can hone our craft. We recognize the philanthropic money isn't there to support that ecosystem in Los Angeles yet. Now, tragically, that ecosystem didn't grow at the same rate as the art and the theaters did, you know, but then you have, you know, Equity taking the 99-seat exemption, which allowed actors to perform essentially, as people say, for gas money, right? And shifting that that into shifting that from where maybe you weren't paying actors for rehearsal and were maybe paying people, you know, $100 over the course of a weekend, to suddenly saying, hey, now these are minimum wage folks. You got to pay for rehearsal and you got to do for the, you got to do that for performances as well, right? Enter AB5, which again, I feel like we probably all, if we had a conversation, would be like, yeah, that's a good idea. But the unintended consequence of that is, you know, you had this piece of legislation that was, you know, primarily towards a gig thing. And the folks who seem to really be bearing the brunt of that are these theaters that now suddenly have to find, you know, 10 times the salaries that they were paying before. Now, I think it's easy to sort of say the theaters don't want to do that. The bigger question is, how do you do that? And unfortunately, I think what you're going to see on a lot of these things, which may ultimately be good for the economy of theater, is you're going to see a real winnowing of the herd. You're going to see fewer organizations, and a lot of these small theaters just aren't going to be able to make it back. The question is, are we going to be able to find a different economic solution post-pandemic that both includes the audience and includes the philanthropic support at a moment when philanthropic support, we know, is so, you know, is stretched so thin because of all of the impacts of the pandemic?
Tiffany, you're a board member, actually, of the Theatrical Producers League of LA. I mean, where does the league stand on AB5?
Well, the league definitely recognizes that this is going to be a problem for the majority of our members. TIPLA, the Theatrical Producers League of LA, we had a first town hall at Greenway Court Theater in January of 2020, so pre-pandemic, to discuss AB5 and what we can do about it. Where we've kind of landed, actually, is creating this legislation, proposed legislation, I should say, SB 805, which will create an equitable payroll fund, hopefully, if it is voted through and funded. So that will provide small performing arts organizations with adjusted gross revenues of up to $1.4 million to match their contributions to payroll, which should allow small theaters to be able to grow to in a more sustainable way and be able to meet the requirements of AB5 rather than being exempted. So we are hoping that this legislation will provide a carve out in the budget that will support the theaters year after year, not just as pandemic relief.
It sure is a challenging time for so many folks, and theaters notwithstanding. Tiffany Moon, producing director of Greenway Court Theater, Anthony Burns, who hosts Opening the Curtain right here on KCRW. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. All right, back to the theater now and on the stage. The Last Best Small Town premieres at the beautiful outdoor Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga Canyon this Saturday. It tells the story of two neighboring families who live in the small agricultural town of Fillmore in Ventura County. The Millers are white, the Gonzalezes are Latino, and as the play unfolds, the families' lives intersect in ways both big and small. John Guerra is the playwright, and he joins us right now. Hey, John.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm all right. I have been through Fillmore. It is indeed a small town along California Highway 126. So when you go between, what, Valencia, just south of the Grapevine, all the way to Ventura, right, all the way to the 101, Fillmore is right in between.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Describe the town. I mean, why'd you choose to set your play there?
Well, Fillmore is really a particular touch point in my own life. So I grew up in Carpinteria, California, which is, for those who don't know, it's about 10 miles south of Santa Barbara. But we have family in Burbank. So every time we would drive down to Burbank to visit my family, we would drive along the 126 through Fillmore. And what I remember about that, I grew up in the 90s, was just kind of a lot of growth. So there were a lot of like housing developments, new strip malls. I remember the first Starbucks that went in. It's a very big deal. But by 2010, after I'd graduated from college, I'd graduated sort of into the middle of the financial crisis, things had sort of changed. And the play sort of talks about this a little bit. Fillmore was not the hardest hit by far by the financial crisis, but like anywhere in this country, it was not left unscathed. So all of the kind of new housing developments that I remember seeing as a child, and all of this, these new strip malls and things, all of that growth seemed to have kind of slowed. And I remember thinking that, like, gosh, this is such a microcosm for what was going on all over the country, and also what I was facing in my own life, because, you know, I graduated into the financial crisis, couldn't get a job, couldn't get an internship. And I felt like there was just sort of this complete lack of growth. And so when I sat down to write this play, I felt like I had to set it in Fillmore. Like, it was not only the perfect place, but that it had to be there.
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, the story centers on two families, the Gonzalez's and the Millers. They live next door to one another. And I guess the question is, in what ways are they similar, and in what ways are they different?
The play sort of, I think at its core, deals with the sort of limitations of the American dream and how those limitations are felt differently depending on a whole kind of host of factors, including race, gender, age, economic class, geographic location, and time period, because the play is a period piece. And so with that in mind, these two families are so similar in so many ways, except for very specific different aspects. Obviously race being one, but economic class being another. There's a lot of conversation throughout the play about how these differences and similarities sort of interact, and where kind of tension is built between them, and where they can also connect. The play is, I think, at its heart, a love story. So in that sense, the way that these families interact is through their children, who fall in love over the course of the play.
Well, these are the kids. They're Elliot Gonzalez and Maya Miller, right? They're both teenagers when we meet them. I want to play a clip of Elliot preparing to graduate high school.
Everyone in my life has all these plans for me. You know, all these things they expect from me. What if none of them happen? What if I leave this place and I end up with nothing? I am the first person in my family to go to college. As far as my parents are concerned, just going means success. Like, I'm automatically going to become a doctor or a lawyer or something. What if it doesn't happen?
Now, Elliot there is talking about a lot of pressure, obviously, often put on the children of immigrants. Why did you want to explore that?
Well, as I said, the play kind of centers around this question of how the American dream is felt differently by different people. And so with these two families, we have one family, the Millers. They are a white family. They're very assimilated to American culture. The kind of burdens that are placed on them by the American dream are more along the lines of the burden of perfection and the burden of keeping up appearances. But that is not the same for first, second, and even third generation immigrant families. And so with Elliot and with the Gonzalez's, I was really interested in looking at how the children of these families tend to hold their parents' sort of version of the American dream within their own selves, within their own futures.
Do you see, John, your own story in both of these families? I mean, how do you relate? Obviously, there was something inside of you that was like, I need to tell this story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I myself am mixed. My mom's family is from Mexico. Her parents grew up in Boyle Heights. My dad's family is from Oklahoma. So in a lot of ways, these two families are sort of like two aspects of my own identity. And over the course of the play, I've sort of populated it with a lot of details from my life. I wouldn't say it's a biopic, but it's certainly a piece that is in conversation with aspects of my life.
Talk a little bit about the theater, the Theatricum Botanicum, which is a beautiful outdoor theater, Topanga Canyon. How does it feel after 16 months of places being closed and we can't gather together, or social distancing and all of those things? I mean, to have your work premiere in front of a live in-person audience, how does it feel?
It feels like coming home. You know, it can't be understated, the effects of the pandemic on the theater community, the arts and culture community, just kind of as a whole. But the theater community is the community that I know. And so I mean, it feels magical to be back in space and watching actors work and being a part of this kind of collaborative creative process.
I wish you the best of luck. I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us. John Guerra, playwright in North Hollywood. His play, The Last Best Small Town, premieres over at Will Geer's Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga Canyon this Saturday and runs through November 7th. Thanks so much, John, for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for chatting with me.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the LA City Council is set to approve a new anti-camping ordinance. Compassionate end to homeless camps, or will it criminalize homelessness? Check out the stories of the day, by the way, and easily subscribe to the podcast, too, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. That's kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears and for your time. Have a great night.